This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in today. Nearly 15 years ago, on September 11th, a flag was raised by three firefighters in the rubble at Ground Zero. Here's the History Channel talking about what that flag meant to people.
They had no idea what that flag was going to do.
Instantly, it strengthens a nation gripped by terror.
In the face of this horrible disaster, its value is incalculable.
But then, inexplicably, it vanishes.
It vanished, and that flag stayed missing for 13 years. And then in 2014, the flag showed up in Everett. A Marine had seen that History Channel program about the lost flag, and he saw the flag's very distinctive halyard, and he saw the mess of electrical tape on the ropes, and he thought, you know, that looks a lot like the flag that's in my back bedroom. So he delivered it to the Everett Fire Department. Everett Police Detective Mike Atwood and his partner got assigned to verify the flag's authenticity. And today, they are in New York City to unveil the flag at the September 11th Memorial Museum. I spoke to Detective Atwood from the site of Ground Zero, and he said they still don't know how that flag went missing on September 11th.
From the ropes and items that we have, it looks like it was cut down. So there's actually a video on YouTube on the night of 9/11. There's a person walking through the scene, and the camera pans by the position where the flag was, and it is gone. And that was about 5 hours after it was raised.
As you were investigating this case, what to you were the most compelling pieces of evidence that you had the flag you thought you might have?
Right before Christmas of 2014, just previous to that, Detective Maffio and I had driven the flag over to Mr. Schneck, and he had done his analysis on it. This could have been a $14 flag, or it could have been a monumental flag of that I wouldn't ever be able to put a price on. And when he told me that there was debris from Ground Zero in the little cracks and crevices of that electrical tape embedded into the material of that flag, I knew then and there. I didn't know if it was a dust flag, but I knew that we were well on our way to a really good place.
Detective, why does it matter to you the authenticity of this particular flag?
With any moment in time, with any important moment in time, I think it should always be made right. And you don't really see the end result and the impact it has on people until you're at situations like I'm at currently today. One of the most impactful moments I've had of this whole thing was we have an officer on the Everett Police Department. He's a retired NYPD sergeant. He moved up to Everett well after 9/11, but he had a big role down here on this site. And when we turned this flag over to the 9/11 Museum, Officer Golden is his name. He was, because he's a humble guy, I had to push him out in front, and he folded that flag for one of its last times that we had it in our possession. And I'll never forget when he grabbed onto that flag, he held it up to his face and was able to smell it. And he turned and looked at me and said, "That's the smell I remember from 9/11. And he was totally convinced that that flag was here. So that was pretty impactful on me.
Detective Mike Atwood of the Everett Police Department, along with his partner Jim Massengale, they investigated the mystery of the lost Ground Zero flag. That flag now hangs at the 9/11 Memorial Museum in New York City. And today, the museum's director said the American flag is finally home. This is KUOW's The Record. Thanks for joining us on The Record today. I'm Bill Radke. Think of an introvert in your life. Quiet, good listener. They'll go to a party, but they won't be the life of it. This morning, we're going to meet an introvert who learned to thrive in the spotlight with a little nudge from a friend. Here's Radioactive Surya Hendry.
Meet Grace. This is a jaw from a six-gill shark. It's the shark that's on the wall over there.
She's 16 years old and a volunteer at the Seattle Aquarium, where she chatters away to visitors about the scientific exhibits. It's no mystery why. Grace adores science, the way it answers the questions you never thought to ask. She ruled over all of us in chem last year, casually acing the exams we all struggled over. But chattering away to a group of strangers, that's more mysterious. As of this past fall, Grace was as quiet as the fish she describes every day. She was the girl who wouldn't raise her hand in French class, wouldn't talk to me at parties. And for the most part, being a wallflower didn't bother her. Then in January, there was a history presentation.
And so we had to give speeches and we were graded on how much we spoke.
Students gave speeches one after another. Each speech was impromptu and built on the speech before it.
Throughout the whole thing, I was like really afraid and I was really pushing myself to speak, but I couldn't. I was kind of afraid that I was going to say the wrong thing, not going to be able to speak, that I was going to like stutter and stuff.
She just couldn't stop second guessing herself.
What am I going to say? Well, maybe I've already talked enough. Do I know what I'm going to say? What should I say?
Grace was swallowed by her own emotions.
Frustration, doubt, fear, panic.
The assignment ended and she could already feel the tears brimming over her lashes. She hadn't been able to speak enough. Her classmates headed off to lunch.
And I kind of just like wandered around outside. I was definitely crying.
It was the first time her quietness had spelled destruction. Silence had always just been part of her identity. She moved from China to the States when she was 4.
I guess I was still speaking Chinese, and so I had to, like, learn English, and I wasn't comfortable with speaking.
Introversion and a language barrier sentenced her to silence, preventing close friendships.
I had friends in elementary school, except they weren't really my friends. And then eventually in junior high, I think I realized that the reason I wasn't close to them was because I never talked.
And I didn't get it. I love talking. I love the way my enthusiasm can become contagious. I love to rattle off debate points, recite poetry. I love to perform, and I couldn't see why she didn't. I mean, she's incredibly smart, 4.0 in all advanced classes, and if she ever studies, I've never seen it happen. She's articulate, too, when she actually talks. But maybe she could learn to like the limelight. So there was this club, the Future Business Leaders of America. And it had a regional speaking competition about a month after the history presentation. If we placed well, we could attend a state competition in the spring. I asked her to be my competition partner. The format was intimidating, to say the least.
My partner and I were given 20 minutes to prepare for a 7-minute presentation.
The entire presentation was like a conversation, dependent on ability to speak up, act confident. Improvise.
Conversations are basically impromptu speaking. I think that is kind of why I'm also bad at conversations.
Grace doesn't like the rush, the banter.
My brain just doesn't work like that, man.
If Grace and I wanted to sound like natural communicators in front of the regional judges, we had an ocean to cross. So we got together to practice. I wanted to jump in and rehearse every possible presentation technique. Grace wanted to grab a snack, sip some water, rattle on about school stuff, the weather, anything to avoid practice. And yet, little by little, we improved. The day of the competition arrived. I knew we would succeed. We were escorted to the judges. We were ready to go. She introduced herself, shook the judge's hand, smiled winningly, and crashed.
I was kind of like fumbling around for words to say, for stuff to say. Oh my God, I'm running out of stuff to say. What do I say? What do I say?
We squeaked into 6th place, barely qualifying for the spring state competition, which was both incredibly competitive and 2 months away. As I organized practice days, Grace, ever the scientist, volunteered at the Seattle Aquarium.
In my interview, they asked me what my greatest weakness was, and I said that it was communicating with people.
That weakness couldn't last long. After all, her job required her to talk.
Well, you have to sound enthusiastic, otherwise people won't want to listen to you if you sound like you're dead. You know, when you speak and you sound more confident, you kind of become more confident.
Confidence and enthusiasm, the hallmarks of a good presentation. And I guess those skills, are what made it so that at the state competition, we introduced ourselves, shook the judges' hands, smiled winningly, and...
Oh my god.
We won second place in the state.
I was, at that point, really comfortable with speaking. It was good.
She had proven herself. She could simply do more now.
I thought it'd be a good idea to start a club, TSA, and that stands for Technology Student Association. Starting a new club will involve a lot of giving presentations, being someone who's approachable, getting information out to my club members, things like that. And so it requires a lot of communication. And because I've gotten so much better at it over the year, I feel like this is a thing that's very doable for me.
Despite all this, Grace is still an introvert. If you found her at a party, Grace would still be the one in the corner playing games on her phone. If you found her in a classroom, Grace would still be the one that never raised her hand. It's not that her quietness has disappeared. It's that it can't control her. And that's why if you found her in an aquarium, Grace would be the one chattering away by the six-gill shark.
And so actually, all sharks, they grow rows of teeth.
For Radioactive, this is Surya Hendry.
Right up. And so about every 2 weeks, a shark's tooth will only last about 2 weeks.
Radioactive is KUOW's youth media program. You'll find us on Facebook at Radioactive Youth Media. It's KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. A few minutes ago, we were talking about the story of the American flag that was raised in the smoking rubble at Ground Zero on September 11th. Well, we're going to talk about athletes, including Seattle Seahawks, refusing to stand and salute the American flag during the national anthem. And we're going to have that conversation with NBA Hall of Famer Kareem Abdul-Jabbar coming up in about a half an hour here on The Record. Now, let's talk about changing Seattle. Okay, you know Seattle is changing. It's a lot easier to really notice that change if you leave Seattle for a while and come back, which is what our next guest did. Luke Burbank grew up here. In fact, he worked here at KUOW. He left Seattle, and he's back in town now hosting his own public radio show, Live Wire, Saturday night at the Neptune Theater. And the theme of the show is homecoming. Luke told me that more and more Seattle is reminding him of when he used to live in New York City.
I was at the Bed Bath & Beyond in Manhattan. And it was a really hot Sunday, and I came out with just like, I don't think you can leave Bed Bath & Beyond with less than 40 items.
Yes.
It's a law that was recently passed by Congress. And so I come outside, and it's super hot and humid, and my options are fight with a cab driver about taking me to Brooklyn where I lived, because they don't like to do that. So you have to get in the cab, you have to lie about where you're going, and then get in the cab and then like plant yourself and say, I'm not getting out of this cab.
I didn't know that about New York.
Or go into the subway system, which is somehow hotter than the above ground area, even though it is subterranean. And I just thought to myself, like, I don't think I can do this anymore. That was like my breaking point with New York. So I moved back to Seattle and I get this apartment on Capitol Hill, and I needed stuff for the apartment. And I had a rental car still. And I got in the rental car and I drove to the Bed Bath & Beyond, like by Northgate. And I bought
parked in a huge parking lot.
Yeah. Bought a bunch of stuff. Put it in the car, drove back, parked in front of my house, yeah. Brought it in, and just thought, this is more like it. Now, this is the thing. That was 10 years ago. I don't think I could make that journey in Seattle now with the same ease that I did 10 years ago. I feel like when I am in Seattle, and I love this town, I think of this as my hometown, I have more of those New York City moments where I think, how am I going to get through this crush of people or cars in this particular area. So that's a different feeling for me now being in Seattle. It used to be a shelter from the storm, and now it just kind of feels like another huge, unlivable city a lot of the time.
You're in Bellingham now. Did you leave Seattle for a smaller city because of that?
You know, it's big enough that there's stuff going on, but it's still a place where you don't have to sort of do that traffic calculation. Like, this is either 20 minutes or 4 hours,
yeah,
depending on the traffic. You can park places. We went and saw a movie the other day, and we just drove. And this is in the middle of downtown Bellingham, in the heart of the action. We drove down there, and we pulled into a parking spot in front of the movie theater, and we got out of the car, and we went in and saw the movie. And I was just like, this makes my life feel livable, I guess.
Does that make you old?
Yes, 100%.
You okay with that?
Sort of. I mean, it's something that I'm making peace with. I mean, when I was a young person, and everybody's wired differently, but when I was a young person, I think a lot of my self-esteem came from this idea that I could make it in a place like New York or Los Angeles. I really liked coming back to Seattle and then bumping into someone and saying, oh, yeah, I live in New York now.
Yeah.
Like, that gave me a feeling like I was somebody. But what I realized, particularly when I lived in New York, was I was paying this exorbitant rent. I was, you know, very far away from my daughter, far away from a lot of the people I love. And part of me was doing it because I knew somewhere in New York that night, the Rolling Stones were playing an unannounced show somewhere on the Lower East Side. Mm-hmm. But I was watching Top Chef in my apartment like I would be in Seattle. Like, I think I always wanted to be where I thought the action was. But then when I looked at how much of the action I actually took a part in, it was pretty limited. And coming back to Seattle, the Northwest, and then also ending up in a place like Bellingham has been me learning that I think that was me wanting to distract myself from being alone with myself.
Wow. A big reason I'm asking you this stuff is because there's a lot of people in Seattle who have problems with how Seattle's changed, that it's lost its soul, it's tech bros, it's trafficy, it's unaffordable. And you are a living reminder that you can leave, you know, but we don't all know what kind of trade-offs that would be to our identity or, you know, whatever our thing is.
Yeah, everybody's got a different situation. But I have to say that there is life after Seattle for people. I used to think that it was kind of a capitulation. You'd bump into somebody at a party when you're living in Seattle and you'd say, like, how's it going? And we moved out to, you know, Fall City. And my thought that would go through my head was like, God, what happened to you? I'd like to thank our listeners in Fall City for their recent donations to the KUOW fundraiser.
Yeah, we'll refund. You should see that reimbursement on your credit card in the next statement cycle.
But I have to say that now, and also I just turned 40 this year. I think a lot of it has to do with age maybe for me. But now if I hear somebody say, oh, yeah, we moved out to Carnation and we're living on 20 acres and we're, you know, just living a really different life, my thought is like, wow, you did it. You got out.
Yeah.
Which is not to say that everybody needs to feel that way, but it's certainly been my experience.
Should everybody leave a place where they're comfortable just to stay alert?
I don't believe in that. I listened to your interview with Ben Ha and his wife, and that seemed to be Ben's theory because they moved to the Bay Area. Of course, Ben is the guy that founded I Can't Has Cheeseburger. One of the people, I think.
So he can has a lot of options.
Yes, exactly. It's like, yeah. So I think he was the one that said that, just to kind of, you don't want to get too comfortable in one place. I have the complete opposite opinion. If I ever actually get comfortable somewhere, you have to pry me out of there with a crowbar. I was talking to somebody a little while back about kind of my unintentional life philosophy, which is, I don't want this to be how I live my life, but unfortunately it seems to be. I think of my life as this very sheer cliff face that I'm climbing up, and that if I can just get up to the next ledge, which means maybe a nicer house or a better job or whatever, there will be enough room on that ledge to just lie down on and rest.
Yeah.
And you get to that ledge and it's really small actually, and you go, it's the one ledge up. That's the big ledge. That's the good ledge. And I think the problem is that when I get to that ledge, I'm still there. So I would not make the argument that somebody has to keep pushing themselves into being a little bit uncomfortable so as to stay interesting or engaged in life. I'm looking for a ledge that I'm comfortable on. And if I find it, I'm staying there. And it might be Bellingham.
That's Luke Burbank, host of the public radio show Live Wire. He is back home in Seattle to do a live show Saturday night at the Neptune Theater, and his theme is going to be homecoming. You can get tickets by going to the events page at KUOW.org. Also, Luke Burbank has taken control of the KUOW Twitter account right now. He told me he wasn't quite sure what to do with it.
It's very professional and respectable and informative. Three things that I've never been accused of being.
Uh-huh.
So I'm really unsure what I'm supposed to do, and I don't want to get you guys banned from Twitter.
Which is nice of him, which is thoughtful. So we're going to see whether we do get kicked off Twitter or what happens through the hour. You can follow Luke. In fact, I suggest it. Go follow him now at KUOW, and we'll check in on the existence of our Twitter feed later this hour on The Record. It's KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. Let's talk about death, shall we? In a way that we didn't used to be able to talk about it. You know, for most of the 20th century, mourning a death was a very private thing and very personal. You would do it with a small circle of friends and family at special times and special places, separate from our everyday lives. But University of Washington doctoral student Nina Caesar says social media have changed that. Because of Facebook and Twitter, now you're just confronted with death much more often.
And you're not just confronted with the idea of death, you're confronted with these traces that did belong to somebody at some point.
What do you mean by traces?
So when somebody, if somebody passes, they leave behind this profile, right? They leave behind this digital remnant, this record of their life that's very present and visible, and something that people can still even interact with in some way.
And you have studied how do we talk about death and mourning on Twitter, because that's different from Facebook, of course. So what have you found?
Yeah, I think my co-author has a point about this that I think illustrates it really clearly. And she says that mourning in Facebook is like going over to someone's living room, someone that you know, and sitting down with the close friends and family of the deceased and having a conversation about them. But on Twitter, you can imagine a neighborhood where everyone's doors are open and you can walk into any one of them and offer your thoughts about the deceased. You know, we can think about the network structure as being different. On Facebook, usually you know your Facebook friends offline. They're mutual connections. So when you friend someone, you have to feel confident they're going to friend you back. On Twitter, that's not the case. Network ties are directed. So you can connect with someone that you might not necessarily know offline, or you might not necessarily know if they're going to reciprocate that connection. You can even tweet at someone that you don't know. And Twitter's also suited to sort of information broadcast and diffusion, too, as well as social networking. So it's kind of this fluid, semi-public, almost semi-anonymous public space, right? It's not like Facebook, where it's kind of an extension of your offline network. It's more of a part social networking, part information diffusion space. And because of that sort of difference in publicness and that difference in site structure, we kind of expected to see maybe patterns of mourning emerging in this space that previous literature hadn't addressed yet.
How do we talk about death and mourning in the more diffuse space of Twitter?
We saw sort of three major themes emerge. One is that in some cases, people do use Twitter as a personal space, and we see comments from close friends and family, very personal, intimate communications and expressions of mourning, right? It's sort of paralleling what's been done in Facebook and MySpace. We also saw reactions to sort of high-profile figures, people who maybe had some sort of following prior to their death on Twitter, because Twitter is sort of this broadcast space. It's a space where celebrities, scholars, politicians go to sort of create an extension of their persona. It's this public-ish space. And so people reacted to the deaths of these high-profile individuals by sort of commenting on their body of work, commenting on the significance that they had during their lifetime to that person, and using kind of more prosaic funerary language. But what we found most interesting is that we also found cases where private individuals invited strangers into the conversation. So a private individual would die, and something about the circumstances of their death would spark public interest and invite people to come into this space and comment on that. And oftentimes, even though they were acknowledged as an individual, the responses kind of linked their death to broader social issues like mental illness or like gun control. And it became a conversation that kind of extended beyond them and wasn't necessarily personal and intimate.
You mean here's another person who died of an accidental gunshot? I'm telling you this for a sort of a political reason?
Yeah, someone jumping into the conversation to offer some sort of opinion. Maybe they found out about that person through some other media site. For whatever reason, they got a hold of the Twitter handle, or they searched for it, and they were able to sort of jump into that space and say, you know, it's a shame this person has died, but I think this is going to teach us something about issue X, Y, or Z.
So, Nina, one social media effect is I can experience the death of someone I know personally,
mm-hmm.
and there's a whole lot of strangers commenting, for whatever their reason is, on the death of someone, that person that I knew. Have you studied or thought about what the consequences of that new reality could be?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. It's not one necessarily that our study addresses. I guess in response to that, I can sort of point out that within the context of Twitter, we're seeing these comments emerge, and we're sort of saying that they emerge within a conversation space. But this conversation space isn't necessarily a dialogue. So if we're searching for mentions of a person, we can kind of get this feed. It sort of has some sort of timeline. It often corresponds with important events in the life of the deceased. And it kind of ebbs and flows and follows themes. But this isn't necessarily people talking to each other or even seeing each other's posts. So when we look at these feeds, we often see conversations going past each other. So a comment from someone who knew the deceased and is engaging in some sort of intimate mourning connection with them, right next to a comment that offers some sort of almost a referendum on their decision making and the circumstances of their death. And I don't know if those people are communicating in some way outside of the context of this feed. It's possible that they are, but it's not necessarily a direct dialogue with one another. And that can kind of influence whether or not there could be repercussions on the people who did know the deceased.
I could imagine that being a more honest conversation than the one I'm only going to have with my family members and close friends. We're all going to talk about how wonderful the deceased was and, you know, a lot of comforting and not a lot of information. Whether I like it or not, it might be a more real interaction when I look at how people who aren't crying with me, you know, I see what they have to say, like it or not.
Yeah, and I think the sort of anonymity that Twitter offers, if you look at the profile of a Twitter user, it's pretty sparse. There's not a lot of personal information there. I think that anonymity kind of potentially invites people to offer more honest opinions on some of these cases, right?
Do you have any ideas about how that might change us?
I mean, it's hard to say. It's hard to sort of draw connections between what's going on in these spaces and what's happening in society as a whole. This could be very context dependent, right? But in these contexts, we're seeing this acceptability of public mourning, and there's always potential for that to sort of bleed through to other contexts as well. So maybe if it's okay to talk about the death of someone that you knew personally on Twitter, maybe it'll become more acceptable to sort of talk about that event with not just close friends and family, but acquaintances or coworkers. Within this context, I think we're seeing more of a publicness in our acknowledgement of death that we haven't seen in recent years.
Nina Caesar is a doctoral student at the University of Washington in the School of Sociology. She's thinking about modern conversations about death, and she co-authored a study on the subject, Death and Twitter, with Jennifer Branstad. You've been listening to KUOW's The Record. KUOW Seattle, I'm Bill Radke. Earlier this hour, you heard Luke Burbank explain how Seattle sometimes can feel as crowded as New York City. Well, for many people here, that's a good thing. They want a denser Seattle. They want more multi-occupant buildings, better transit, fewer parking spaces for cars, except that a big reason to live in Seattle is how easy it is to get out of the city into nature. How do you do that if you don't have a car? Sarah Bernard examined that question recently for the Seattle Weekly. She describes herself as a nature nerd, and she used to have a car for weekend adventures until somebody hit her car and totaled it.
I started to really ask myself, okay, why do I want a car? Why did I use a car? And the only reason really is to get out of the city. I love the wilderness surrounding Seattle, and myself, like many, many people I imagine in the city, is a huge priority in my life to go hiking and camping, backpacking.
In fact, that dilemma that you're now living, Sarah, That's bothered a lot of people so much that there's probably lots of groups, but you wrote about the Citizens for Livability in Ballard. And what is their argument about parking in Seattle?
Well, they've made a few arguments, but their argument regarding car ownership, essentially, they filed an appeal to the Seattle 2035 plan, which would, among other things, turn parts of Ballard into what Seattle is calling an urban village, meaning transit-friendly, really dense development, transit-friendly with no minimum parking requirements in the new development. That doesn't mean that there wouldn't be parking, but no minimum requirements. And so the group in Ballard is concerned that this influx of people, these people are going to move in and they're going to have cars. And the reason that the group believes they would have cars, and one main reason that is included in the public document, is people make choices to own a car, not only because of how they get to work and not only because of how they get to the grocery store and not only because how they get throughout the city, but because of how they get out of it. And so it's a believable, it's an understandable argument and a real question I think Seattle's asking itself right now.
So help me make sure I understand this group's claim. They want the city to change its plan for growth, plans for the future, so that there are more parking spaces to accommodate people who are never going to give up their car, because it doesn't matter how much transit there is in the city, they want that car to go camping, etc. So they filed an appeal to actually have the city do what?
Well, I don't know exactly how effective it's going to be, but to have the city change its plans and ultimately have some minimum parking requirements associated with new development in the city. So building a new apartment, requiring the developers to include a certain number of parking spaces in that development, assuming that people who are moving to Seattle will have cars, they will own cars, and just sort of that kind of feeling that this is inevitable. And the real argument for that being people want to get out of the city.
But we have car rentals. We have apps now, car sharing apps. It's easier than ever to sort of call up a ride. What does this group say about that?
I think it's sort of like it feels inevitable that the culture that we understand that exists so far is that people want what they want when they want it. They want to get out of the city. I think there's a lot of spontaneity that's lost when you're required to plan ahead to rent a car or reserve a car share or negotiate with your friend to borrow their car or whatever it is. There's something I think that's really appealing, I think, for a lot of people about just being able to walk outside, grab the vehicle and go, you know, make a decision, a split decision on a Saturday morning and say, I really want to go and nobody else is available. I just want to go for a hike or something. I think there's spontaneity that's lost there.
These people who want more parking spaces in the city to accommodate cars so we can head out on the weekend, do you think that's really all they want, or is this another way of people wanting the city to just not get dense and saying, don't build so many houses so there'll be more room for our cars and we'll have the Seattle we've always had?
Mm-hmm. I think it's both. I mean, I think there is a lot of nostalgia right now and a lot of frustration on the part of some people who've lived in Seattle for a long time and have an idea of what Seattle was. And there were a lot of, are still, but were a lot of single family home neighborhoods, lots of, you know, trees and single houses, and there's plenty of space to park your car and plenty of space to sort of spread out. Even though you're in an urban environment, it sort of felt spacious, I think, until recently. And now the population explosion has been changing the city so dramatically, so rapidly. I think a lot of people feel frustrated by that, although I imagine that, I mean, the wilderness argument is a valid one as well. So I think it's sort of a legitimate way to think about why many people do own cars. Even the people who are moving here from elsewhere, I think the appetite for the wilderness is really strong in Seattle.
Yeah, Sarah, when you combine density and traffic and parking, and then you throw in the element of you want a car to do what? To go to the Cascades, the Olympics, the San Juans, you're getting at who is the city for? I don't want it. I get that you don't have to have a car in Manhattan. I didn't fall in love with Manhattan. This is supposed to be Seattle. Mm-hmm. To me, that's your article is kind of getting at that itch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess exactly. It's sort of like, what is Seattle? I think this is a big question right now in so many ways. But associating with the wilderness, I mean, there's so many people here who want to be here because of this beauty all around us. It's so accessible. It's incredible. It feels like, to me, you know, I've only lived here for a few years. I feel like I'll never see it all. It's amazing. It's endless. It's incredible. That's why I want to be here. And I think, you know, a lot of people probably feel confused or frustrated by this idea that suddenly this place that was sort of a reasonably sized city with all this access to the wilderness is becoming something that feels so much more clogged, so much more congested, so much denser. Is this Seattle? Is this what we want Seattle to be? You know, I guess it's just a really big question.
Should I feel guilty if I just want to have a car in Seattle so I can get out? Should I feel bad?
I don't think so. I don't think, you know, I don't think guilt is very healthy, but also it's understandable. I mean, for me anyway, for me personally, the wilderness is such a big priority for me. I understand car ownership for that reason. I mean, that's absolutely understandable to me. I think there will be more people, there will be more people moving to the Seattle area. And if we're just building the city out and out, it'll be harder and harder to maintain the very things that we love so much about living here.
So what are you going to do, Sarah? Are you going to get a car?
No, not right now anyway. I'm going to try this carless thing for a little while, see how it goes.
Sarah Bernard wrote for the Seattle Weekly about why it's hard to remove cars from a city we love to leave when we want to be in nature. It's KUOW's The Record. A state of emergency, a task force, a $50 million investment. These are all measures the city of Seattle has taken over the past couple of years to try to solve the homelessness crisis. Still, thousands of people remain unsheltered every night. Now, the city will overhaul its approach. City officials released a report today from national experts, and they laid out their plan to put recommendations into action. KUOW's growth and development reporter Joshua McNichols is here to walk you through it. Hi, Joshua.
Hey, Bill.
What is the biggest takeaway from this report and the city's new plan?
That we can solve this problem with the housing we already have. Their solution wasn't just to build a whole bunch of new stuff. It was, even though, you know, that's going to help in the long run, but unclog the system. They say the system of shelters and the path to housing is clogged up by a bunch of people who are basically camping out in shelters, and they consume the lion's share of the resources. Get them into housing, and suddenly that frees up more resources to help other people, people who maybe don't require quite as much help to get back on their feet again.
Well, that sounds hopeful, but that's a pretty remarkable goal. The city's talking about getting everyone who's on the street now under a roof within 3 years. How can Seattle achieve that?
Yeah, pretty ambitious goal, huh? And it's in less than 10 years, they say they could have everyone who's currently staying in a shelter housed. So they're going to do that by investing in a system that they say is much more effective. It's called rapid rehousing, which is where basically you get people into housing and help them quickly pay, you know, 3 months rent or something like that. Because despite what you read, not everyone who's homeless has insurmountable obstacles. A lot of people just need a little help. And rapid rehousing, it's enough for the majority of people. Adrian Quinn of King County's Human Services Department says the latest data suggests only 3.7% of people who go through a rapid rehousing program here locally return to homelessness. They'll still have other programs that are more intense, you know, permanent supportive housing for people with mental illness and addiction issues and things like that. But those will focus on the people who need them most. It turns out that because we're kind of disorganized, a lot of people who may not need help quite as much are getting some of the more expensive services.
But Joshua, we're used to high hopes here. Seattle had a 10-year plan to end homelessness, and it ended miserably. If you look at the numbers, what's different now?
Okay, I put the same question to Megan Curtiff-Schatz, who worked on one of the two reports that was released today. I asked, what's different this time?
Data. You now have the information available to know who is homeless in your community and what happens to people in the inventory of programs that you have. And so you can now make the changes.
She went on to say that the way we collect data has matured a lot because the federal government has standardized the kind of data we collect about homelessness. And so we can use more than anecdotes as a way to decide who gets what funding.
Now I want to talk about a shakeup that's part of this plan, Joshua. The city's talked about only funding services programs that get results, that get people into housing. What does that mean for service providers?
So it means some service providers are going to lose funding. We saw that already. Sharon Lee of the Low Income Housing Institute kind of snuck her way into the press conference this morning. They run a transitional housing project called Columbia Court in the Central District, and they got a letter that they wouldn't get $36,000 this year from the county, and that pays the salary of their social worker who helps get people into housing.
I hope that the mayor and council doesn't blindly adopt these recommendations because I think they're flawed. And so therefore, I think that there needs to be continual discussion. In the meantime, we know how to, and we should get all the homeless families off the street this winter, not at the end of next year. This winter would be ideal.
So Lee made a lot of claims about the report's inaccuracies, and I ran her claims by the county. They say she's using inaccurate anecdotes to dispute what they call overwhelming data, which clearly indicates where we should invest our money. Now, we've only just received this report, so it's hard to evaluate these claims on either side yet, but it's something we'll want to look at going forward.
Joshua, 30 seconds left. You've been covering homelessness for months. What is a red flag when it comes to this report and the city's plan to implement it?
Well, it's so ambitious. There are some things that they have to do. They got to get the landlords on board. A big part of using the stock that we have is getting landlords to accept people who are formerly homeless, who might have evictions on their records. And what level of incentives are they going to provide so that landlords will want to do this?
KUOW's growth and development reporter Joshua McNichols walking us through a plan city officials released today to attack homelessness in a new way. Joshua, thank you.
Thank you.
It's The Record. The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for joining us. My next guest has actually been a successful writer for a lot longer than he was a star athlete. NBA superstar Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is a best-selling author. He writes about race and justice in the Washington Post and Time magazine. His new book is called Writings on the Wall, Searching for a New Equality. Abdul-Jabbar made his own very public statement about inequality in 1968 when he boycotted the Olympics. So I asked him what he thinks of the controversy over NFL player Colin Kaepernick, the San Francisco quarterback who won't stand during the national anthem.
Colin Kaepernick, he's concerned about what's happening. People being shot and killed for no good reason other than they have dark skin. And that's a real issue. It's not something that he thought up. I think he can find a better way to protest it and to try to help find the remedy. Not standing for the national anthem or wearing pig socks isn't necessarily how he should approach that, in my opinion. I'm not trying to tell him what to do, but I appreciate what his concerns are, and I hope that we can get to a point where we have a solution that makes sense and that he can participate in.
You say this might not be the best way to express himself. It's certainly got a lot of attention. One Seattle Seahawks player joined him last week. A couple others just told the Seattle Times that it might turn into some kind of team-wide statement. What would you tell them?
I would tell them just to be careful. You don't want to alienate the people that you're trying to win over. So in order to do that, you have to understand their concerns and approach them in a way that shows respect. But they have to respect the fact that they're trying to achieve something that needs to be done.
Did you alienate more people than you wished you had when you boycotted the Olympics?
No, I don't think I did because there was no boycott, really. For me, it was just a question of I had a good job and I wasn't going to go to the Olympics because Avery Brundage was still the chairman of the U.S. Olympic Committee. And he's the one that didn't want to let the Jewish athletes participate in the 1936 Olympics because it was going to offend Hitler. And I wasn't going to do anything for him. So I said, I got a good job. I'm going to do that. And Avery Brundage can do whatever he needs to do.
What about as a professional athlete? What did you risk to say something important?
As a professional athlete, I think that people kind of saw me as kind of distant and somebody that had a chip on his shoulder at times, because my own natural personality was I'm a very shy and quiet person. Just the fact that I didn't want to engage people gave them the opportunity to interpret my silence or reticence to engage quickly as hostility. And I didn't think that did me any good. John Wooden told us while I was at UCLA that...
This is your coach.
My coach, John Wooden, at UCLA, my basketball coach. He said that, you know, the press can be a problem. And so I always dealt with them cautiously and at a distance, and that didn't do me any good. You have to engage with them. They work with you. They interpret what you do for the public. So you have to find a way to deal with it in a way that doesn't alienate them. Of course, when I was playing in the early 70s, a lot of the members of the press were pretty, I won't say pretty, they were very conservative and felt that black athletes should know their place and keep their mouth shut. I could see that, and that also added some tension to the whole situation.
I wonder if your experience in the early 70s, that experience, colors how you're saying, wait a minute, Colin Kaepernick, be careful about alienating people when it comes to not standing during the national anthem. But, you know, the NFL says it's okay. His team's not punishing him. President Obama seems okay with it. Could it be that maybe even fans, they understand this is his speech?
Given what we've seen over the past couple of years, all these people dying and, you know, being shot for no good reason, the one that gets to me the most is the kid in Cleveland. I mean, he's just standing in the park.
Tamir Rice.
He's just standing in the park. And cop just literally jumps out of his car and shoots him dead. He was just standing there. And things like that happen like that, they shouldn't be happening. So we got to do something about that. We need to train the police better. We need to also get people in the various communities that have tense relationships with the police to understand how to approach them. There needs to be a bridge there. I think that professional sports athletes can do a great job by being the means by which the bridge is achieved. And I hope that they take advantage of it because they're very popular. Geez, the Seahawks are so popular up here. They've won a Super Bowl and everything. I'm sure that people will listen to them, and the various police chiefs and, you know, heads of the various sheriff's departments in Western Washington, they're all Seahawks fans, you know. They have a great opportunity there, and I hope they take advantage of it.
So do you want to call on Russell Wilson to, hey, use your, you're a star, you're in your prime. Colin Kaepernick is not even the starting quarterback anymore. Do you want to say to Russell Wilson, stand up and talk while you matter?
Actually, today I'm going to meet with the Seahawks. So
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
What are you going to say to them?
I'm going to find out what's on their mind and talk about these issues and just tell them how to negotiate it in a way that it's a win-win. You know, every tense situation can be a win-win if the people have some sense and some respect for each other. So, you know, that's what I'll be talking about.
How can it be a win? What could the Seahawks do? You don't sound completely comfortable with sitting during the national anthem.
No, I don't think that's really the way to do it.
Okay.
Because people don't understand it. Why? You know, they want to know why. You got to really inform people. You can't have a very important issue, a burningly important issue on your mind and not explain yourself. Got to explain yourself.
Okay, so I'm a Seahawk player. Mr. Abdul-Jabbar, I'm interested. I want to be part of a solution. I've got this mouthpiece as an athlete. How should I explain myself? What do you think I should do?
Well, you just talk about, all right, we mentioned Tamir Rice earlier. Two of the Cleveland Browns protested about it because they weren't protesting because they were Cleveland Browns. They were protesting because they were the parents of black kids who could end up getting shot like that. And they didn't want that happening to their kids. That's what this is all about. It's very basic. It's nothing elaborate. It's not a communist plot, you know. It's people worrying about their family and the people that they love. If you can explain that, you're able to bridge a great distance when people understand that this is just a very basic issue that we need to improve, because this can't continue like this.
Okay, but now I'm Russell Wilson. What about my fans who love me and the companies that endorse me and can take away millions of dollars from me?
Well, I don't think they'll be of a mind to do that when they see that you're trying to build something positive. You know, you're not trying to say, let's eliminate the police departments. The police are the glue that keeps our nation safe. It's the thin blue line. That's a very accurate description. But there are times when they get in over their heads, or they don't understand what's going on, and they do things that end up becoming very unfortunate, sometimes tragically unfortunate. So we gotta work on that. And the people in the community got to understand what the police are going through, and the people in the police departments have to understand how what they do affects the people that they are there to protect and serve. A lot of times they have contempt for the people. Police officers that have to work in poor neighborhoods that have a lot of crime, a lot of people there that have criminal backgrounds, you know, that's not an easy job. So everybody has to understand what the issues are and what the solutions can be. And that is all about communication, one to the other.
Talking with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who's written this book now, Writings on the Wall, Searching for a New Equality, are there signs of progress that you want to leave us with, signs that we are moving toward a new equality?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, people are starting to talk now, and they're starting to voice their opinions about what needs to be done. And when it's done in a respectful way and in a way that the other side can understand what your issues are, all of a sudden we're going to start to understand how we can fix things. That's what everybody wants. We want solutions. We don't want more antagonism. We want solutions.
Former NBA Basketball Hall of Famer Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. His new book is Writings on the Wall, Searching for a New Equality. He's at Seattle University tonight at Connolly Center, 6:30, talking with Seattle sports writer Art Thiel. And as he said, he's meeting with the Seattle Seahawks today, discussing their next move as they open their season at CenturyLink Field on Sunday. And what might complicate any national anthem protests this Sunday is the date. It will be September 11th. You're listening to KUOW's The Record. You can also follow us on Twitter at KUOW. Luke Burbank has taken over our Twitter feed at KOW for the rest of the afternoon. Hope you enjoyed that conversation. You can find the whole show on your favorite podcast app, iTunes. Thanks for tuning in today.